This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This technology is capable of producing energy twice as often, so twice as much energy per single system, with only about 20% of the material.
The wind. It flies our kites and fills our sails, and since the 7th century, humans have been harnessing its power to pump water and mill grain. So how far have we come since then? The modern wind power industry didn't really start until the late 70s. Yet, over the past 3 years, worldwide wind-powered energy generation has doubled. But this endlessly renewable power source is still relatively untapped and only accounts for about 2% of global electricity usage. This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from two wind power executives about the burgeoning potential of wind. First, we talk to Michael Payne, a 15-year veteran of the industry who's helped develop some of the world's largest wind energy projects in the US, Europe, and Asia. He tells us about the technical, environmental, and regulatory hurdles that the industry faces. Next, we speak with Corwin Hardam, the CEO of Makani Power. This company, whose name means wind in Hawaiian, is developing a cutting-edge way to capture the power of the wind using airborne wind turbines that fly like kites and generate more power than conventional earthbound turbines. Today on Sea Change Radio, we ask, is the answer blowing in the wind? So my guest today on Sea Change Radio is my good friend Michael Payne, who has not only been the director at Enron Wind, he's also been the general manager of business development for Europe and Asia at Shell Wind Energy. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be doing this.
Walk us through, how does like a medieval windmill, just the ones that we always associated with Holland, how does that differ from some of these enormous 300-400 foot turbines that are just three simple blades, just in terms of the physics of it?
Well, I think, you know, some of the fundamentals are very similar. So the wind blows, the wind turbines either turn automatically or they are turned manually into the wind. So the old ones that you see in the Netherlands, for example, have been restored, are designed such that an operator who lived in the base of the machine would turn the windmill so that it faced directly into the wind. In that way, it had full energy capture, and it also wouldn't tear up the machine. The modern wind turbines have a weather vane mounted on the top, which is attached to a computer, and monitors the wind directions. And as the wind direction changes, it has what are called yaw motors, which actually are connected to big teeth and will turn the wind turbine into the wind and make sure that it's always facing directly into the wind. So, you know, things like that, that concept remains the same. The actual implementation of keeping it facing into the wind has changed and evolved as technology's improved. You know, what happens next is that you have to convert the energy of the spinning blades into something else that's productive. In the old wind turbines, old windmills, you have wooden teeth and gears which converted the rotation of the rotor into a rotating shaft, which would then turn a millstone to grind grain, or would turn an Archimedes screw to pull water out of the polder and dump it over the dike. Nowadays, you have a gearbox, which converts a shaft spinning at what would be, you know, maybe 18 revolutions per minute into a high speed, you know, 1400 revolutions per minute, and goes into a generator, you know, depending on what type of generator is being used. So there's different technologies and improvements that have certainly taken place in that area. And then, you know, obviously you're converting electricity in one case versus mechanical energy in another. And that's very different.
And why the height?
why? I mean, I've read about the Enercon E126, which I think is a 7-megawatt turbine that's been developed in Germany, and it's this 435-foot turbine, and it's just one huge one, as opposed to seeing a smattering of these other small ones like we get in Northern California at the Altamont Pass. What's the difference between those in terms of strategy from a production standpoint?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a couple of important principles. One is that the energy, the electricity and the energy capture increases with the cube of the wind speed. So a little bit more wind energy gives you a lot more electricity, a lot more energy. So that's why people are going higher. So they're trying to optimize the return on the investment in the foundation and the wind turbine by spending more money on the tower. And by getting up higher, you can capture a lot more energy and wind, and therefore you generate a lot more megawatt hours over the course of the year than you would if you had a slightly shorter tower. And the reason that is is because the winds are stronger farther off the ground, and that's just a function of the friction of the air against the Earth's surface and you know, exists around the world. So in brief, you're capturing more energy more with the same amount of fixed cost, and therefore you're increasing your return on your investment. Why are they doing that in Germany versus in other places goes to the wind shear, which is the difference in wind speed at lower altitudes versus higher altitudes in Germany versus in Altamont Pass. So Altamont Pass is a very windy area. Northern Germany is not a windy area. They're very low wind speeds there. So the differential justifies it in Germany, and it doesn't justify it in California is the short answer to why it's happening one place and not the other.
And from a cost perspective, which is usually thought of as a bigger investment, are they comparable, having 10 40-foot turbines or one 400-foot turbine?
In general, the trend in the industry has been towards larger turbines. So what you see over the last 15 years, and the amount of time I've been in the industry, a 550-kilowatt machine was sort of the standard product back in the mid-90s. And today, you know, a 2.5-megawatt machine is probably the standard product. And there are 5- and 6-megawatt machines that are being developed primarily for offshore applications, but also for onshore applications in places like Northern Germany, where you have other issues around getting permits for wind turbines and siting them, and maybe some preference for fewer turbines versus more. And therefore, a larger installed machine is going to be a more successful product.
My guest on Sea Change Radio is wind energy expert Michael Payne. What are some of the major hurdles that the industry is facing right now, Michael?
So one of the biggest hurdles to growth for an industry, any clean tech industry, is having a stable regulatory framework to operate in. And this is true for the wind industry. It's true for, you know, electric cars, you name it. And the fact is, you know, as we get our arms around climate change and the challenges we face there, we're having to implement laws to support a transition towards a clean economy and a clean energy. And that costs money, and politicians don't like to pass long-term pieces of legislation that cost lots of money. They want to do it incrementally. They want to make sure they pick the right technology. So, you know, one of the biggest challenges the wind industry has faced is sort of on again, off again support, and that's damaging in several ways. It prevents prevents companies from making the investments in the long term they need to drive down the costs. And you know, we've struggled over the last 2 years to try and pass some climate change legislation in the U.S. Many of the other countries in Western Europe have passed much more comprehensive carbon reduction policies, including things that drive the penetration of wind energy from low levels to, you know, 10, 15, 20% of the total consumption by, you know, target dates of 2015 or 2020. And we're talking about that, but we haven't yet been able to do that in the U.S. So that I would say first is a major challenge, is we need to really address the need to make a transition with our stationary power generation, you know, as a carbon emitting source, power plants effectively, and that will allow technology companies to make the investments to drive down costs. So that's the first one, the key one. The second one, coming behind the wind turbines and the power plants themselves, is making sure you have the transmission infrastructure to move the product from the places where it costs least to generate to the public and the load in the cities on the east and the west coast primarily. And that's going to require, you know, a major amount of investment and development in order for that to happen. In addition to sort of the investment, it requires really some strong coordination between the states and the federal government in terms of the permitting for these power lines. And so we're talking about high voltage transmission lines going across a variety of different states to get from, say, you know, Kansas or South Dakota to Chicago, or, you know, from the plain states into the southeast where the resources just don't exist for wind power generation. And that is something that a lot of people are working on now, but there needs to be some success stories before that actually happens. You know, with those two big pieces in place, I think you'll see a lot of growth in the wind industry going forward. I mean, you know, there are issues around permitting. They will continue to increase in as the percentage of wind turbines goes up, and as more projects are developed, the more contentious permitting becomes. But I don't think in the U.S. that's really a constraint compared to these other issues. So offshore is really what's driving the large turbines above the 2.5 megawatt size. And then onshore, you have sometimes permitting issues, which is driving that in certain specialty markets like Germany. But permitting captures the aesthetic, visual impact issues, as well as a lot of other issues.
And another very important challenge facing the industry is obviously that of intermittency. What happens to our energy needs if the wind just isn't blowing as much as we need it to?
You know, from my perspective, having seen the way a number of other countries are advancing as compared to the United States, I don't believe that intermittency is a major issue. It's more of an issue for the grid operators and the grids to manage this than it is a real technical issue. And it's an economic issue, not a technical issue. And we can support a certain amount of intermittency with the assets that we have in the ground, and that's the gas-fired power plants and the coal-fired power plants that are out there, and the hydroelectric in particular. And as our wind penetration increases above certain levels, we will need to build more dispatchable power plants, and those will be largely gas-fired power plants, because gas gives you the ability to turn it up and turn it down much more easily and conveniently than something like a coal or nuclear-fired power plant. Hydroelectric is great, but it's site-constrained as well. So, you know, that's really the solution to the intermittency.
How much gas are we talking about? Because these are supposed to be very low carbon footprint solutions. And is this why companies like you've worked for, like Enron and Shell, have gotten into the wind game?
Right. It's a good question. I don't think that's why either of those companies were participating in wind. But, you know, there's no question that gas is going to be an important fuel for the future. I mean, from a low carbon perspective, it is a low carbon fuel compared to coal. It's you know, half the carbon per megawatt hour of electricity. And, you know, that's a significant decrease, you know, before you apply any sort of new technologies to reduce it further. And you know, the amount of gas that we consume will continue to go up as we increase the penetration of of solar and wind technologies. But, you know, from my perspective, we're not at the point where that's a constraint for the installation of new technologies, because I think you have grid operators who are just now being forced to think about how to manage the flow of electricity more closely as we begin installing these larger wind farms around the country.
Wind expert Michael Payne, thanks for being my guest on Sea Change Radio. Hope you can join us again soon.
Thank you, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My next guest on Sea Change Radio is the CEO of Makani Power, Corwin Hardam. Corwin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
First, tell our listeners, what is Makani Power?
Makani Power is a startup in renewable energy and wind. And so we're looking at a new way of doing wind energy conversion. And we're looking at, so converting the energy in the wind into electrons, into electricity. And as opposed to using a turbine, one of those three-bladed large things you see on the side of the road in various places around California, particularly Palm Springs or Ultimate Pass, we're looking at actually using something that looks like almost like a kite. So it's a wing that's attached to the ground with a flexible tether. And as that wing flies around, it's got small rotors on it, and those rotors convert the speed of the kite into electricity and then send that electricity down to the ground where it can be used just as electricity generated from a wind turbine or a coal-fired power plant.
Corwin, what is Makani Power today in terms of an organization?
Makani Power is about 20 scientists and engineers working out of Alameda. We're actually working out of the old Alameda Naval Air Station. We're in the control tower there. And we're developing prototypes of airborne wind turbines.
And you're funded by?
We're funded by Google. And also recently we won one of the RPE grants from the DOE. And we're actually working two milestones to that RPE project at this time. So we're developing a 20 kilowatt scale model of our airborne wind turbine, which we'll be flying in the next couple of months.
And for our listeners, what does a 20 kilowatt system mean in terms of how many households?
Yeah, so 20 kilowatts is about 10 households. Usual household in the U.S. is about 2 kilowatts on average power consumption.
And how does it compare to the large turbines that we see in an Altamont Pass and other wind farms that listeners may have noticed driving by?
Makani Power is focused on the utility-scale energy generation market. We're not interested in building individual small-scale generation equipment. And the reason for that is the fixed cost of the Makani system, the fixed cost of an airborne wind turbine, are relatively high at small scales. So whereas you can have a small wind turbine on top of your house, has one moving part, no electronics or very little electronics, our system has to have its own autonomous navigation system built into it, which is somewhat expensive relative to the scale of a small device. At utility scale, at megawatt scale, similar to the large structure, you know, the 300-foot tall turbines that you see at the very large wind farms, that cost of that avionics system is very small. And for that reason, because of these fixed parts that we have to put into our system, we focus on doing these larger scale devices. And the reason for having the fixed costs are not the only reason we focus on utility scale. At utility scale, we see some very significant performance improvements on the system. So larger scale systems tend to perform better than smaller scale systems, and they're easier to fly as well.
Can you talk about how you envision Makani Power being able to roll out enough of these airborne wind turbines to produce enough power to begin to deliver electricity on a mass scale to consumers?
This technology is capable of producing energy twice as often, so twice as much energy per single system, with only about 20% of the material.
Is that because of the altitude generally?
It's actually has very little to do with the altitude and has much more to do with the way the device operates. The way this technology works can be thought of almost identically to a wind turbine, so it's exactly the same physics. You start with a wind turbine blade, and if you look at a wind turbine blade is moving very quickly at the tip and very slowly at the center. Now, if you look at the very tip of the wind turbine, it is the most effective part of the wind turbine as far as generating energy. And what that means is that since it's going the fastest, it's also sweeping through the most area. And what you'd like to do is you'd like to just have that very effective tip. So, in fact, what we've done with Makani is we've made a wing that's tethered to the ground, which mimics the effectiveness of the tip of the wind turbine. And what's interesting about the Makani system is because we're tethered to the ground, we're no longer constrained to fly around that small annulus that a wind turbine tip does. We can now sweep through the sky in a much larger circle. So imagine a circle that's maybe 1,000 feet up, and it's maybe 500 feet in radius. So it's a very, very large circle. that we're flying through. And by virtue of that, we sweep through a very large section of the sky. But more importantly, the entire wing, which is about the same size as one blade of a wind turbine, is moving at this higher speed. And so therefore, it's able to see much more of the wind than a wind turbine would. And by virtue of that, is exposed to much more wind energy.
And when you talk about one wing, you also can there's a multiplier effect as well with these wings in terms of scaling this out to the masses, right?
So you can certainly install multiple systems. And the neat thing about that is that because the wing and the tether are very lightweight, so our single system mass is about 20% of that of a conventional wind turbine. So we're much, much lighter than a conventional wind turbine. And that means that it's easier to deploy these. You don't need any cranes. These systems actually launch and land themselves completely under computer control. And the other thing that's very nice is there's no very large infrastructure required to manufacture them. So the wing itself is fiberglass and carbon fiber. It can be made in many different fiberglass shops. It certainly can be made in wind turbine blade manufacturing shops. The tether is carbon fiber as well, and the ground station is metal and concrete, but it's much, much lighter than a wind turbine tower or the nacelle, and particularly the hub and some of the large mechanical pieces that are up in a wind turbine. What's neat about that is that as you look at technologies that can scale very rapidly to meet an opportunity, a resource opportunity, this technology, airborne wind turbines, is very suited to rapid scalability because we're very lightweight, so it's easy to deploy. And also by virtue of the fact that we're low mass, it's easy to manufacture. And take that one step further, the components, the simplicity of the components is relatively well matched to what the existing manufacturer base is that can be found just about anywhere across the world.
More from my discussion with Makani Power CEO Corwin Hardam in a moment. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the CEO of Makani Power, Corwin Hardam. Can you walk us through the invention of airborne wind turbines? Is Makani the first of its kind to produce an airborne wind turbine like this?
So Makani is certainly not the first of its kind. I would say we are the first to demonstrate that the idea is indeed possible. So we're the first to have done autonomous flight of a tethered wing, autonomous power generation, and transitions from hover to crosswind flight with a tethered vehicle. So those are sort of first demonstrations of enabling of the technology. But there have been many instances where people have looked at this in the past. So in the 1970s, a fellow by the name of Miles Lloyd at Lawrence Livermore Lab wrote an extensive paper on this technology. And he highlighted and then patented most of the fundamental tenets of the idea. Since then, what we've done is developed and enabled and actually realized the invention in a prototype.
And what about planes and birds? Are these going to be in peril as Makani rolls out more and more of these wind farms?
There's a couple of things, first of all, to set straight. The Makani, we're not flying that high. Even at utility scale, we fly at around 1,000 feet. So 1,000 feet is, there are buildings that are that tall, there are radio towers that tall. So the FAA is used to, maybe I shouldn't say used to, but they have certainly negotiated this problem before in the past. And the way that this is done is you note where those are on pilot's maps, and you, of course, have to notify airmen where those farms are, where we would be putting these farms, and then it seems like it's a solvable problem. And it's not something that the FAA has published a rule set on. It's something we're working with them on. but it is something that I think we can navigate safely, such that we don't run into planes, planes don't run into us. There are a number of hurdles with land use and competing desires for land use and so forth. First of all, one of the nice things about Makani is because we are much more insensitive to resource, in other words, we can operate in less wind than a conventional turbine, we're more flexible about siting. So if, for example, you have a choice about siting, you can decide to site outside of, say, a migratory path, a place where perhaps birds of prey might want to fly, in other words, a ridgetop or something like that. And we can also avoid siting in places where people would have complaints about, you know, changes to their view shed and so forth. So being able to site in many different places is a huge improvement over the existing technology, having that flexibility. In terms of, specifically in terms of birds, I think it's important to stress that there has been a little bit of a misconception by virtue of some of the stuff that was seen in very early turbines, but in general, modern turbines kill very, very few birds, almost none. And
probably a lot less than oil.
Certainly a lot less than oil, but really, frankly, dramatically less than buildings, dramatically less than cars, all dramatically less than cats, for that matter.
Really?
So there's a lot of, there are some misconceptions about that. I still think that it's something to be very sensitive to, and something we plan to be very sensitive to as well. Because we're flying at a higher altitude, we don't, you know, birds of prey will be beneath us, which is nice. We don't have any high perching spot for birds to perch on. So, of course, one of the problems with conventional turbines is birds like to nest on the back of the nacelle, and then they're very close to the moving blades. However, again, I'll just stress that, you know, large-scale wind turbines, because they're moving so slowly, birds can typically see these large blades. And so that's a lot of, that's gone a long way to getting rid of the problem of birds running into wind turbine blades.
Well, it's a fascinating technology, and we really appreciate you walking us through it. Corwin Hardam, the CEO of Makani Power, thanks for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. Sway the future to the
past and find what will endure. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by George Benson, Stevie Wonder, and David Bowie.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialist. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more.
Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.